Under a spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. The smith, a mighty man is he, with large and sinewy hands. So begins the classic poem written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in 1839. But if Longfellow were alive today, he would be hard-pressed to find any immense chestnut trees in his hometown of Cambridge, Massachusetts. The mighty American chestnuts that once made up nearly a quarter of the eastern forests in the U.S. are now all but gone, thanks to a blight inadvertently imported from Asia in the early 1900s. But now botanists are working to bring back the American chestnut by breeding in resistance to the Asian blight. And nowhere is their work more anticipated than in the hills of Appalachia deforested in the quest for coal. Reporter Jonna McCone has our story.
Thick stands of tall, regal chestnut trees, sometimes called the redwoods of the East, once dominated the forests of the eastern United States. Michael French is a forester with the American Chestnut Foundation.
The old timers used to say that when the chestnuts were in bloom in June and July, it looked like the ridge tops were covered with snow because of all of the chestnut flowers.
These days, it looks very different. Not only are the chestnuts gone, but from where I'm standing on a mountaintop in Dickinson County, Virginia, the rolling green mountains that stretch into the distance also bear the scars of a history of coal mining. And you can hear the next peak over being torn apart for coal.
We have some active mountaintop removal just on the next ridge over.
Nathan Hall is reforestation coordinator for Green Forest Work, a nonprofit that helps restore former coal mines by planting hardwood trees.
So there's rock trucks dumping out big loads of what they call overburden. That's it falling down the mountain right there. So that's a big chunk of a mountain sliding down.
Across central Appalachia, nearly 750,000 acres of mountains have been strip mined for coal. That's an area larger than the state of Rhode Island. Underground mining started here around the Industrial Revolution, but it wasn't until the 1930s that surface mining became widespread. That process strips everything off the surface of a mountain, using explosives and heavy equipment to access the coal underground. Dave Fisher from Kentucky is a farmer and small business owner who's worked in coal mining for much of his life.
Coal has fed my family. Coal has fed generations of my people. You know, all my uncles are coal miners. My grandfather was a coal miner. His grandfather was a coal miner. I mean, and it's just generational. That's what we do. That's who we are around here.
He's seen firsthand the way mining changes the landscape.
You would have huge tracts of land that all the dirt and rock and everything, trees and everything removed, and it was flattened out. You're talking quarter acre wide, a mile or two long, of just big open fields.
Fisher says what's not coal is just in the way.
Anything over top of your coal, they call it spoil, because it spoils your coal.
As environmental awareness grew in the 1970s, several key laws were passed, including the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, or SMCRA. The law forced coal companies to fund the cleanup of abandoned mines and the reclamation of active mine sites. Al Whitehouse, Director of Reclamation at the Office of Surface Mining, or OSM, says early efforts didn't consider restoring the ecosystem.
OSM and SMCRA had the belief that a surface mine, when reclaimed, should be smooth as the baby's bottom, as it were, and that compacts it, and it wasn't the kind of land that was really the best for forests.
Whitehouse says the science and policy of restoration has improved. Today, mountains must be returned to their approximate original contour and fit a designated post-mining land use. But it's up to landowners to decide how the land is used after it's mined.
So the state has a role to make sure that the land capability is back, but has no role in dictating what kind of economic interest the landowner pursues. I mean, that's private business. If an old guy wants to raise dairy cows and wants a pasture, then that's certainly one of the acceptable post-mining land uses, and if that's what he wants, that's what he'll have.
At the Dickinson County site, the post-mining land use was hay and pasture land. Nathan Hall from Green Forest Works looks out at the old mine.
Nowadays, they're using a better seed mix than they used to, but for years and years, they would intentionally seed out a lot of what we see on this site, which is like Chinese Lesbedeza and European fescue and various things that don't belong here. That's why we have this sort of alien environment on most of these sites. Almost looks like it's been kind of painted green on those lower areas.
Kentucky business owner Dave Fisher says coal companies wanted to reclaim the land as quickly and cheaply as possible.
They just wanted the dirt to stay in place for 5 years so that they can say, well, we've done our part. There's a hillside back, and it's yours.
Restoration efforts didn't make use of native plants and failed to understand the historical land uses and culture of rural residents.
When you look at a place that's undisturbed in this area, the plethora of wildlife and the different nut trees and the different essential plants that we have here. At one time, people made their living from just going and collecting ginseng and yellow root and blood root. And none of that is ever put back on the mine land. And very seldom is any of the hardwood put back.
But hardwood plantings are increasing, thanks to the efforts of universities, environmental groups, and landowners. Now some are hoping to restore former mines using native species, including the American chestnut. Fred Hibbard is chief scientist with the American Chestnut Foundation. He says the chestnut tree was once a staple of life for people across Appalachia.
The logs provided fencing to keep cattle out of their gardens, and then lumber from cradle to grave. People would be rocked awake in a chestnut cradle and buried in a chestnut coffin, live in a chestnut house shingled with chestnut bark.
Once some 4 billion chestnut trees blanketed the eastern U.S., but by the end of the 20th century, the tree was nearly extinct. An Asian fungus was to blame. In the early 1900s, gardens full of exotic and ornamental species were all the rage. With imported plants came pests and fungus, including Cryphonecria parasitica, likely brought over on Asian nursery stock. Within 30 years, the fungus spread from Maine to Louisiana, killing nearly every towering and defenseless American chestnut in its path. Though some American chestnuts survived for a few years before succumbing to the blight, they all but disappeared from their range. As early as the 30s, scientists were working to bring the tree back from the blight, but it wasn't until the 1980s that scientists started backcrossing the American chestnut with the Chinese chestnut, a tree that coexisted with the blight for a millennia. Using the Chinese tree's resistance to the fungus, they hope to breed an American tree that can survive the blight. Again, Fred Hibbard.
The only thing you want from the Chinese chestnut is the blight resistance, whereas you want to retain all the other characteristics of the American chestnut other than its susceptibility to blight. And you essentially want to throw out everything in the Chinese chestnut other than its resistance.
That's because the Chinese tree is squat like an apple tree rather than towering and straight like the American tree. The backcross chestnuts at the American Chestnut Foundation Research Farm in Meadowview, Virginia, are essentially 15/16th American and 1/16th Chinese. Pathologist Laura Georgie is introducing the fungus to trees that contain a mix of Chinese and American genes. She wants to determine the most disease-resistant individuals.
So this is where they were inoculated. We had two different strains that were inoculated of blight fungus. The lower is the more severe strain. The upper is the less severe. What we have here, the lower site is a lot of dead tissue. The bark is sunken here. There's orange, and that's the fungus. Up on top here, this is a little bit better looking.
Using trees bred at the farm, scientists are planting what they expect are blight-resistant seeds and saplings on former and active mines. Again, Michael French.
When you look at the range of the coal fields and the range of American chestnut, the two overlap almost perfectly. So if we can establish little founder populations all throughout Chestnut's range on surface mines, you know, it may help us to reach forests that we might not otherwise be able to plant in.
So far, tens of thousands of Chinese American chestnuts have been planted. Back at the Dickinson County mine site, Michael French and Nathan Hall lead the way along a flat, barren-looking ridgeline to check on a recent planting.
Let's walk up here, actually. I'd like to take a look at some of my chestnuts. I just wanted to see how they're doing now that they're leafed out.
The men stop to admire a small sapling.
Isn't it beautiful? It's almost 2 feet tall and only 3 months old. What do you think?
That's from seed?
Yeah, from seed.
Yeah, it's nice.
There's a good one right there, too.
They hope the chestnut population becomes self-sustaining.
So by mixing them in there with northern red oak, yellow poplar, sugar maple, all of these other species, we'll be able to see can the American chestnuts outcompete the other species to where they're able to flower and produce seed for squirrels, turkey, blue jay, deer, so that natural processes can continue, evolution, you know, spreading the seed to other areas.
Early data suggests that well over 80% of the chestnut trees are surviving. In a few years, scientists expect the chestnuts will start producing seeds to grow a second generation of trees. Nathan Hall looks at these mountains and sees unrealized potential.
As somebody that grew up here and who's most of my friends still live here, I see every day the tremendous need for physical work for people to be engaged in, not only for the money aspect, but also to give people something to do and a sense of cultural identity, because as the coal mining is moving away from this area and moving out west to Montana and Wyoming, we're left with a big question of what we do. To me, there's a big opportunity to get people back to work doing restoration and remediation of these lands.
That could mean opportunities for jobs in tree planting, ecotourism, growing nut and fruit orchards, and even biofuel crops on old mines.
You don't have anywhere near the economic potential for the region for these areas that are just covered in kind of a blanket of non-native species.
Dave Fisher is looking to the future as well. He recently started a farm and wants to install solar panels on a former mine.
It's a huge burden upon the people that's left here after the coal's gone. What are we going to do with this? It's something that we really need to address.
The struggle over the costs and spoils of coal production is as deeply rooted in the region's history as its small towns scattered through the lush hillsides. And the chestnut is part of that history. Reforesting former coal mines with native species is a long-term investment that could eventually mean the snowy white flowers of the American chestnut once more carpet the mountains throughout the eastern U.S. For Living on Earth, I'm Jonna McCook.
Up, an odyssey to photograph some of the world's oldest organisms. That's right ahead here on Living on Earth. Stay tuned.